All right. So we just talked about five stubborn facts. Facts are stubborn things. And no matter how we may feel about them, we cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. There were people in the time of John Adams that did not want a king, and there are people in our day and time that do not want a king today, but they just can't change the facts. The first one of which is that Jesus died by crucifixion. Sometime after his death, the disciples honestly, sincerely believed that they saw the risen Jesus. After that, Paul the persecutor became the preacher. James, the skeptical brother of Jesus, became a preacher of the gospel as well. And finally, 3 days after the crucifixion, the tomb was found empty. We know that because of the city in which the tomb was located, same city in which the gospel was first preached, the city in which Jesus was killed. We know that because even Jesus' enemies admitted that it was found empty. And we know that because of the testimony of women. On the top of page 42, I have a quote from Sherlock Holmes. "Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth." If you take those five facts and you harmonize them, you have to ask yourself, what's the best, most sensible, consistent way to explain all five? I maintain that the best way to explain them is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead by the power of God. There are many other alternative explanations that people offer up. We'll start talking about them tonight. Hopefully spend a couple more classes looking at objections that people raise. When you look at the quote from Mr. Holmes at the top, "Once you eliminate the impossible," the skeptic would say that the resurrection is what is impossible. When you look at the alternatives that they offer up, and when you judge them by the naturalistic means that they want to limit everyone to, they want to completely take the supernatural out of the equation, and when you evaluate them by that very standard, they fall apart. And their explanations become what I believe is what's truly impossible. And the resurrection, it admittedly is very improbable. How many of you have seen somebody come back from the dead? Nonetheless, it has to be the best explanation, and it has to be the truth. So, we'll start by looking at some of the things that we've talked about before in terms of naturalistic philosophy. And I want to begin with a quote from the Apostle Paul in Acts 26. This is the third time that his conversion story is recorded in the book of Acts. He's giving his defense before the Romans. And as he speaks of his Jewish background and Agrippa's familiarity with the Jewish nation and their beliefs, he says, "Why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead?" The Jewish resistance to that idea was not a resistance to the notion that everybody comes back from the dead. In the case of Lazarus in John 11, when Jesus shows up, he asks Mary, "Do you believe that, or Martha, one or the other, I forget which, do you believe that you will see your brother again?" She says, "Yes, I do believe. I will see him in the resurrection at the last day." They all believed that they would be raised. What the Jews held incredible was that God would raise Jesus, a man that told them some very hard things. "You are sinners in need of a Savior. And I am the Son of God, and the things that you say about me are slander and lies, and you've got it all wrong. And you do have a sin problem that needs to be taken care of." They could not accept this, did not want to accept it. And they nailed him to a cross. "He must be a cursed man." And then God brings him back from the dead. That just can't be, because that shows they got it wrong. Paul says, "Why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead?" By the way, that word "if," sometimes "if" means "that." I suggest that's how you interpret it in this verse. It's not that God, Paul obviously has any question about it. Makes it a little more emphatic that way. "Why is it considered incredible among you people that God does raise the dead?" The reason why people today hold it incredible is often because of a pre-existing bias. And that's what I have on the next to the last paragraph below. So tonight we're going to talk about an anti-supernatural bias. Sometimes this is called naturalism. And one of the reasons that people immediately discount the resurrection, which is a miracle, is because they start off with the premise that there is no God. And that has to be true, that if there is no God, then there cannot be any miracles from said God. So let's look on the next page, page 43. And I want to turn over now to the book of Romans, chapter 1. Why is it that people have a bias against the supernatural? First of all, because many of them disbelieve in God. That is not true of everybody that denies a miracle. There is a smaller population that believes there is a God, and that this God did begin the universe. He wound it up like a clock, and then he just turned it loose, and forever after, never really got involved in it. And we talked about that in our discussion on concepts and worldviews. That's called deism. But a lot of people are just flat-out atheists. They don't believe in God, so the resurrection in their mind is indeed impossible. If you look at Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, the Apostle Paul said that Jesus was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. If the resurrection is true, then Jesus is the Son of God. If Jesus is the Son of God, that means that there is a God. That's right. So, we need to talk about how we would address this objection that people raise. I think we'd all agree if there is no God, then there are no miracles, but is there a God? If there is, how would you know? One way, of course, is to look at the very things that we've talked about all throughout this study. You can use the resurrection to show that not only is Jesus the Son of God, but by extension, there is a God. But if you go back to the three mountaintops of faith, we can go back even beyond the crucifixion and the resurrection. We can start from the beginning. What's the first mountaintop of faith? The creation, from which we gather that there is a
God.
That's right. If there is a creation, then there must be a creator. And I want to remind you, look at Romans 1 and verse 20. This is exactly how Paul argues in Romans 1 and verse 20. If this is a verse that you kind of have a passing familiarity with where it is or what it says, but you don't have it nailed down, I encourage you, just nail it down. Memorize the reference. Even if you can't remember the whole verse from memory, just know where it is. Paul argues, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, that being the two invisible attributes he's talking about, those two things have been clearly seen. How is it that that which is invisible has been clearly seen? Is it because Paul was walking along some road somewhere and he just happened to stumble into Jehovah? Found him in the back room of a small house tucked away in a city? Or is it because of the next thing that he says? They have been understood, that is, his eternal power and divine nature. It has been understood through what has been made. So that they, those that deny the truth of God, verses 18 and 19, they are without excuse. What Paul is saying is there is no logical way to arrive at the conclusion that there is no God. All of existence argues to the contrary. When we talked about concepts and worldviews, we pointed out that atheism is, first of all, illogical. All of creation says the exact opposite. There has to be a God. That's his argument here. Look back up in verse 4, the text that we read a short while ago. He was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. It's not simply a matter of logic that there has to be a God. It's also a matter of history. If I know nothing else, what do I know? I know that Jesus died by crucifixion. And what happened after that? What's the second one? They believe they saw him risen from the dead. Then the fiercest enemy of Christianity, who was that? Paul. He converted. James, a confirmed skeptic, became a believer. And what happened on the third day? What did they find?
Empty tomb.
Empty tomb. If I know nothing else, I know that. Atheism is not simply illogical. It is ahistorical. It is not concerned with history. And if somebody tells you they don't believe in God, it may be that you hear this even before you've had a chance to sit down and make the case, and it may be that they're not interested in hearing it. Probably that would be true of every objection that we have on this lesson. You may not be able to get through to them, but what if it's your grandchild or your child? What if they ask you, why shouldn't I think there is no God? These two mountaintops, you start from here, and frankly, you can't climb any higher. I've referenced this text more than once throughout the last couple months. I want to go to Acts 17 once more and remind you that this is how Paul started. When he went to Athens and he preached about Jesus and the resurrection, he was not talking to people that believed in the Bible. They had no concept of Jehovah, of inspiration. Thus saith the Lord meant nothing to them. So how does he talk to those people? He mentions the unknown God in verse 23 that they have erected an idol to. And then in verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Which mountaintop is he standing on here? Creation. Then he goes down to verses 30 and 31. He wants to give them information that there is a God, the one true living God that they worshipped in ignorance. But then he says, it's not enough for you to know something. This has to transform you. So in verse 30, he talks about repentance. And in verse 31, he gives the reason to repent. There is a judgment day coming. And what's the last phrase in verse 31 that proves there is a judgment day coming?
He raised him from the dead.
Raised him from the dead. It's not a thus saith the Lord. It's he raised him from the dead. If I don't know anything else, I know my five facts. And what do my five facts point to? He raised him from the dead. So if someone says they don't believe in God, if you've got somebody that questions why you should believe in God, start here. Start with the creation. Start with the resurrection. There is no firmer foundation for you to lay than these two things here. Often, though, if people don't believe in God, they will believe in something. And it's a bit of a misnomer for people to say that there are people in this world that have faith and those that don't. Everybody's got faith in something. I don't care who you are. It's just a question of what you believe in and why you believe in it. Whether or not you've got a good reason to believe in it or that's just what you prefer to believe. And the second thing here also would explain why some people don't believe in the resurrection. They disbelieve in God, and instead they put their belief 100% in science. Why? 2,000 years ago, when Paul was living, did he have any idea how to make some form of communication pass around the globe instantaneously?
No.
Via satellite? What about open heart surgery? Was that a thing of the first century? Nuclear technology? Any of that? We've come a long way. Nobody would deny that. We're blessed to live in the time in which we live. And I'm often reminded of God's delegated authority to man and woman in the creation account. He gave them dominion over the earth. Man has fulfilled that promise even when he argues that there is no God. Science has allowed him to really harness the power of the earth and to extend his dominion over it. There's no doubt about it. And so because of that, somebody might say we should only believe in what science can prove. Science cannot prove the resurrection. Is that a true statement?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Is that a troubling statement? Should it be?
No.
Can science prove that you were born? Think about it. We're talking about the scientific method where you have to test something over and over and over. You have to repeat an event over and over. Can you repeat your birth?
No.
Absolutely not. Even Nicodemus was perplexed at that when he didn't understand what Jesus meant in his discussion with him in John 3. Science cannot prove the resurrection, so that raises another question. Is science the only way to know that something is true?
No.
It is not. One way to know that something is true is the scientific method, but what's another way? the legal, historical method. We talked about this in our concepts and worldview class. If you don't have that marked on your page there, I gave you the reference to pages 4 and 5 under the section on evidence. The legal, historical method. This is how you answer the question of whether or not George Washington actually lived. Was Martin Luther King a real person? Do you prove that by the scientific method or the legal historical method? Legal historical method. So, if somebody says I should only believe in what science can prove, I shouldn't believe in Martin Luther King Jr. I shouldn't believe in George Washington's existence. I shouldn't believe in a whole host of things that I only know from history and from testimony of other people. I shouldn't believe that my parents are my parents, because I only know that by testimony. And I weigh that testimony against evidence just like people do in questions of guilt or innocence in a court of law. I raise another question. If someone argues that we should only believe in what science can prove, that begs the question. Has that belief been scientifically proven? Did they take the statement, you only believe in what science can prove, did they take it, put it in a lab, and they test it through the scientific method? You don't have to know the first thing about science to know, no, of course they didn't. And yet they say, you should only believe in what science can prove. If they actually mean that, they shouldn't even believe in what they just said, because nobody has proven that scientifically. There is no reason for them to put their faith in simply science alone. When we talk about believing in the resurrection, we are talking about certainty beyond reasonable doubt. I said that all the way back when we talked about evidence. Certainty beyond reasonable doubt. You can have confidence that Jesus was raised from the dead, and yet at the same time, there can always be the possibility that you have believed the wrong thing. I can have confidence that Patrick and Belinda are my parents, and yet, yes, it's true. There's always a small chance that maybe I was abducted. And they are not my parents. And they've lied to me. But I have no reason so far to doubt their testimony, because the evidence that they are my parents is so great. I have no reason to doubt what the Gospels say, because so far the evidence is so great. If I know nothing else, I've got 5 facts, right, that weigh in favor of the resurrection. Okay, questions or comments about these first 2 reasons to not believe in the resurrection? Alex.
There was an old movie. I don't know if you've ever seen this. In Search of Noah's Ark, and they also made another one called In Search of Jesus Christ. And there was, you know, the film was produced by atheists, but they did not deny that Christ existed. But they came out with some really convoluted theory of what happened. You know, they believe he was buried in a state of suspended animation, and somehow he woke up and, you know, escaped and, you know, proved to everyone else that, you know, he was resurrected. That's their scientific theory of what happened. But they did not deny that he existed.
That's their scientific theory of what happened. It's not scientific at all.
No.
Mark? Right.
Right after all. So, and that's just 2 things about which they've been wrong for thousands of years.
Right.
Why in the world did he make them, they say, as a resistance to the scriptures?
There's
wrong so much.
Right. Scientists approach their work oftentimes with presuppositions and assumptions that have not been validated by their own method. And I don't even have to make the case in this audience that that's true of even how they believe that we got here. Everybody knows that and grants that. So just because someone has total belief in science, in and of itself doesn't prove anything. There should be a skepticism and a healthy skepticism in that very belief that they espouse in science being 100% valid all the time. Building on that, look at the third thing that we have here.
Just one more observation. We should not let it bother us that so many do not believe. It would be interesting to know how many believed the day before the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima that a device was made that could kill 140,000 people in a moment.
Right.
Not believing it didn't change the fact.
How many people believed before the Wright brothers got in the air that man could fly? Just because people don't think that something is true, that ought not shake us. Even when you talk about science, those are good points to make. Oftentimes, even in the realm of science, as Mark and Steve pointed out, you have a large dose of unbelievers that have no foundation for their unbelief. The third thing that we have here, resurrections are disproved by science. Well, is that true or false?
False.
It's true and it's false, depending on what kind of resurrection you're talking about. Science is a method of inquiry that lets us know the workings of the natural world. Emphasis on natural. Do people come back from the dead due to natural causes? Has science ever demonstrated that? Quite the opposite. There is a law in science called the law of biogenesis. B-I-O and then the word genesis. Steve talked about it in his lesson recently on science. Once upon a time, people believed in something called spontaneous generation. They thought that flies and maggots came from meat that was left out and rotted. They thought that if you had a dirty rag and you threw it into a corner, that it would produce rats. But a man by Louis Pasteur came along and other people with their experiments, and they showed that life does not come from non-life. It does not work that way. So, naturally speaking, a resurrection is impossible. Life does not come from non-life. You cannot take a dead body and make it alive. But in the case of Jesus, the facts, the claims, the context, the Jewish nation, the prophecies that they had, they all argue that this was not the result of natural process, but supernatural. The hand of God. And as I said, God's miraculous handiwork always leaves his fingerprints. We are not talking about science when we talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We are not talking about the natural, we are talking about the supernatural, which has left its mark in the natural world by the facts that we have that indicate it. All right, open your Bible to Titus chapter 1. You might read these things and think, I just can't remember all this stuff, and I can't believe that somebody would even think this. Well, I'm planning to do this and two more classes on the objections that people raise to the resurrection story, and we're just touching the hem of the garment as far as the objections that people raise and the alternative explanations that they cook up. There are people that believe Jesus came back from the dead, but he did so because he was an alien. They actually believe it. They say it. And if you meet somebody like that, you can just smile and say, I agree, he was not from this world. But you have to at least understand and be familiar with the fact that there are so many assumptions that people make as to why they don't allow for the resurrection. And many of them are going to teach your kids and your grandkids when they go to college. Many of them have taught us when we went to school. They have taken over higher learning, if you want to call it lower learning, public schools, they've taken it over. So you better be prepared for it and at least understand and take comfort in this, that even oftentimes by their own philosophy, what they say must be true is not even consistent and doesn't work out. I mentioned the law of biogenesis a few moments ago. In high school, in one of my biology classes, first week, they talked about the law of biogenesis, and all these people were so stupid and superstitious, they thought that a rag would produce rats. Here's a feather in science's cap. This is why you need to pay attention and be so glad you're taking this class and not art. And then the next week you go to class and they say, okay, let's talk about how we got here. There was a big bang and a big pot of soup and it got hot, really hot, for a really long time. And then out of this lifeless matter, a single-celled organism came, and then from there, everything else just happened to show up. But you just told me life doesn't come from non-life. From that alone, you can tell that their own explanations for how we got here, they don't work. And the same is true of the misconceptions that we have on our sheet. All right, Titus 1 and verse 2. Sir? Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Whether it's spontaneous generation or the theory of evolution, the same lies are often peddled with a new name and a new face. You're absolutely right. I want you to look in Titus 1 and verse 2 and look at what Paul says about God, about the middle of the verse. God who cannot lie. This is the God that said, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." He wants people to be truthful and honest. And Paul makes the statement here that it is against God's nature to himself be dishonest. Everybody follow? Not hard, right? Okay, so here's what the deist says about the resurrection. He would argue that God created everything to be governed by natural law. Agree, disagree? Natural laws are in place, and he put them there. That's right. We would agree with that, right? So, since he made everything to work by natural law, he would never violate that law. That is against his nature. So he would never raise his son from the dead. He would never part the Red Sea. He would never do any of those things. And as we said a moment ago, we have natural law that says life does not come from non-life. He would not violate that. It is against his nature. He would not bring Jesus back from the dead. So the first thing about this is this. This is interesting that people that say you can only believe in what science can prove, therefore you shouldn't believe in God. They say that this God that you can't believe in scientifically, somehow they know how he would operate. Do they know how he would operate scientifically? Have they proven and tested over and over how God operates or how he does not operate? It seems very convenient that they always argue in a way that makes what they don't want to be true false. And it contradicts their own suppositions and their own philosophy. Look on the next page. Fact is, if there is an all-powerful creator, then there is nothing stopping him from suspending or overturning the laws of nature on a whim. And even more so when it would serve a purpose. If, say, he sent his son to earth and he wanted everybody to know that this being, Jesus of Nazareth, is much more than he appears to be, so he decides to let everybody know that beyond a shadow of a doubt by raising him from the dead, if he wants to do that, he's well within his right. He's the creator. He can do whatever he wants. But let's talk about this natural law thing just for a second. Natural laws are not prescriptive. They are not like, thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Those are laws that tell you the way things ought to be. Do not do that. Natural law is not that way. It is not prescriptive. It is descriptive. Natural law tells you what you should expect to observe in day-to-day life. All things being equal, you should expect that what goes up comes down according to the law of gravity. All things being equal, you should expect that a baby is only going to come from living people. But if God decides he's going to do things a little bit differently, that break the general pattern, and bring someone who was dead back to life, he can do that, and he can do so without contradicting his nature, because these laws are not meant to be set in stone like the Ten Commandments were. Those things were meant to always be enforced and in effect and govern the way man lived, and they were also a reflection of God's holy nature as being that which is completely pure and apart from sin. But natural laws are not the same thing. And then the last thing that we have on that paragraph on the top of page 44, here's the fact. You can say what you want about how you think God operates. Here are the facts. Fact is, Jesus died. People thought they saw him come back from the dead. They believed it sincerely. The tomb was found empty. Paul and James converted. Those are the facts. Deal with it. Explain it. and do so in a way that is just as plausible, if not more plausible, than the resurrection story. Deal with it. All right, the last thing, or one of the last two, we'll go through these kind of quick. David Hume. We've talked about him once before. David Hume is a little bit smarter than the last class of skeptic we talked about. He does not argue that nature's laws cannot be broken. He's just arguing that belief in miracles is absurd. And David Hume is well known in academia. If you study economics, if you study rhetoric, if you study politics, if you study philosophy, if you study religion, you're going to come across David Hume. He's known all over. And even though he's been dead since the 1700s, I think, his legacy lives on. And his argument on the surface seems pretty convincing. Miracles are, by definition, rare. Agree? Disagree? Agree. They have to be. If there is no such thing as natural law, then there's no way for us to identify what a miracle is. If people generally don't come back from the dead on their own, there's no way for us to know something special about Jesus. So we agree. Secondly, natural law describes what we see in nature regularly. Agree? Disagree?
Agree.
Three, we have more evidence for the regular than we do the rare. How many funerals have you been to compared to the number of resurrections that you've witnessed? We agree. And finally, wise people believe something based on the quantity of evidence. Agree? It's a pretty good rule. You can take that into account. So he takes all of this and says, therefore, no wise person should believe in miracles. Well, let's think about that. What he's arguing from, really, is just probability. And I used this example when we talked about this briefly a couple months ago. If he is right, you could never believe that someone hit a hole in one. They are improbable. The evidence for not hitting a hole in one far outweighs the evidence for hitting one. And he's saying you should only believe that which you have the greatest amount of evidence for. So then I would not be able to believe that someone hit a hole in one. Now it's true, people should take probability into account when they decide what to believe in. Let's say that John and Keith and I are at the golf course, and Keith says, I bet $100. I know you don't gamble, but let's say you do.
It's a guarantee.
Okay. He says, I bet $100 that I can hit a hole-in-one. John and I are going to take probability into account when we decide whether or not to take that bet. How many have you hit?
None.
So we're going to take that into account, and we're going to make the smart move, and we're not going to take the bet. And we do make decisions based on probability. All of us want to be safe and we want to be careful. What's more likely to happen? The need for me to wear my seatbelt in the case of an accident, or the need for me to have a radioactive suit in case there's a nuclear fallout somewhere? Which should I be more concerned about? Yeah, the seatbelt thing, right? But wise people don't make decisions on probability alone. It's very improbable for someone to hit a hole in one, but do the facts say that it can be done? Yep. Yep. And you ought to take that into account as well. Okay? And the thing is, with Jesus, how many facts do we have? Five at least. Right? And yeah, it's improbable, but we have a lot of high quality evidence for a strictly one-off event. Jesus is not popping out of cemeteries left and right today. Happened one time, but there's a lot of evidence that supports that. And one of Hume's mistakes is he thinks that just because you have a quantity of evidence, that's the same thing as quality. That's not true. That's not true. I've got five well-attested facts that Jesus did come back from the dead. Ennis?
Wouldn't the over 300 prophecies being fulfilled be something that would cast in that category?
That would be one, yes. I'm not making that argument right now, but yes, definitely. And in a couple weeks, we'll talk about inspiration. And that would certainly include prophecy. If you look at the very bottom of this paragraph, one last thing that I raise. If somebody argues that miracles are rare, and the phrase that they use is uniform experience, so what have people experienced from the dawn of time until now? They would say, well, you know, nobody's seen the Red Sea part. Nobody's seen somebody come back from the dead. If somebody argues that miracles are rare, and uniform experience does not confirm their existence, how do you know? How long have you been around, Mr. Hume? Have you been here since time began? Have you been in every single place all at once? How do you know? If you're saying that you know that there never has been anything to confirm the existence of a miracle, are you not saying that you know everything? Are you not saying that you have been everywhere? And if you're saying you know everything and you're in every place all at once, who are you making yourself out to be?
God.
That's right. That's the thing about people that have a problem with accepting God. A lot of them have a God complex. Very proud, very arrogant, very high on themselves, and Hume is no different. Another thing that C.S. Lewis pointed out as a flaw in Hume's argument, he said that... no reason I can't find it. It's on the next page. He said this was circular reasoning. He said, we only know, he's thinking like Hume would think when he says this, we only know that uniform experience disproves miracles only if we know that every miracle reported is false. And we only know if that miracle is false if it never occurred. So how do you know there never was a miracle, Mr. Hume? Well, they never occurred. Well, how do you know they never occurred? Because they don't happen. You're just running over and over, and you're not getting anywhere. So even though on the surface it seems like this guy's really cracked a tough nut that just destroys Christianity, the opposite is in fact true, and it's not that formidable once you get over it and break it down. Okay, on the last page, we've got just a few minutes left. Another reason why people would say you cannot believe in the resurrection is because there are counterfeit miracles today. How many of us would say amen to that? Yeah. That's another clever thing about the argument. There's not too many people that would not say, probably, that there are not fake miracles out there today. So because there's fake miracles today, they reason there's always been fake miracles and there's never been a real deal. So let's see how far we're going to take that. Is there such a thing as counterfeit money? Empty your wallets and give me all your cash. Don't use cash if there's such a thing as counterfeit money. Is there such a thing as a real estate scam? Can people be swindled out of an investment that's not what it was made out to be?
Yes,
they can. So does that mean never buy and sell a house? People that say this don't even live by that own rule consistently. And moreover, as you go through the Bible, look, for example, at Matthew 7. It has always been true that there have always been fake miracles. It's always been true. Whether you're talking about the Exodus, whether you're talking about the New Testament age, and you're looking at Simon the Sorcerer and other people, it's always been true. But the thing is, people have always been expected to find out the difference and to be able to tell the difference between what is true and what is false. Jesus himself indicated this in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15. Beware of false prophets. Well, to a Jew, you'd think, how do I know so-and-so is a prophet? Same way that Moses showed he was a prophet. He worked a miracle. If you are not a prophet, but you want people to think that you are a prophet, you will devise a fake sign that will look like a genuine miracle, but in fact not be. In Matthew 7 and verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Yet those that are doomed, in verse 22, did we not prophesy in your name, and your name cast out demons, your name performed many miracles? It may have looked that way to a lot of people, but Jesus says in verse 15, they are false prophets, and you need to beware. Don't let them lead you down the same road of eternal damnation. So, we need to know the difference. And in the case of Jesus' resurrection, we don't have to just take the Bible's word for it. We have evidence. I've got how many facts? One, two, five. I've got five. And they point to the truth of what the Gospels say, that there was a man, Jesus, and he came back from the dead. All right, the takeaway then. These are just some of the fallacies of naturalism. It's not even every one of them. On all the objections that they make. But even though they try so hard to package it in this veneer of logic and facts, There is absolutely no reason to embrace it as being logical or fact-based. It is anything but. It is impossible for naturalism to explain the five stubborn facts, nor does it have intellectual finesse enough to dismiss the age, accuracy, the authors, the agreement of the manuscripts, all those tests that we submitted, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, and 1 Corinthians 2. It dies on the hill of atheism. Hume, what hill do you want to die on? Make your stand. I pick atheism, for which there's no reasonable, logical proof for which there's no historical evidence for, quite the contrary. I will die on that hill, and faith will live on the mountaintop. So that's just a survey of the naturalistic explanations that people offer. We've eliminated those. And Sunday, we want to look at the explanations that people offer that sort of all more or less revolve around the idea of legend. And those handouts are available for you in the foyer in the back. Mark, did you have something else you want to say? But like we said earlier, everybody believes in something. And you can either believe in something for which you have evidence, or you can have a blind faith. And the irony is that those that ridicule those of us that try to have an objective faith and look for evidence and assess it, and they say that they are the ones that have all the facts at their command, they have blind faith. It is inconsistent, it is empty, it is hollow. And you know what? It is to be pitied. And I hope that even if the things that we've talked about tonight, they may not equip us to get through to people that we may know or that we may meet and talk to that raise these kind of objections, at the very least, they'll help fortify your faith and mine and equip us to help prepare people that we have in our life that are open to the truth, whether it be your children, your grandchildren, your brethren, whomever. And to help fortify them against the darts of the devil. Thank you for your time and your attention tonight.